Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Fernandez and I, of course, are here. Judge Berzon had surgery last Friday, and he's going to participate at her home through a conference call. Are you there, Judge Berzon?
I am. Here I am. Good morning.
Very well. Feeling okay?
I am. Thank you.
Good. I will call the matters as they appear on the calendar. First item is U.S. versus Somsemuth. Two of them. All right, let's go. Ready?
Yes.
All right.
Is somebody coming to this?
Yeah, someone has to come up. All right.
Well, if somebody wants to argue, you must come to the lectern and begin, start your argument. And there's 10 minutes total, as you know.
Good morning, Your Honor. What I'd like to do is I'd like to start with the issue of the Rule 29 in this case. It's our position that the government at no time throughout the trial presented any evidence of a material false statement in this case. The issue was whether the government proved that there was any material lie in this case. And whether a lie is material with regards to the indictment in this case is whether there was any substantial gainful activity engaged in by the defendants, in which they later told the Social Security Administration about in an interview that wasn't true.
Why is that the only thing that could have been material? Why does it have to be substantial gainful activity, prove substantial gainful activity to be material?
Because the Social Security Administration determines eligibility for Social Security income based on two criteria: whether a person is physically or mentally disabled, and secondly, whether they are producing any type of income. And if persons are engaged in normal physical activities such as taking out the trash or mowing the lawn, that doesn't constitute substantial gainful activity, and it will not and has never affected their ability to receive Social Security income. And it's our position that they at no point ever proved in the trial that our clients ever received any income from any of their activities, or that their activities were such that it would constitute substantial gainful activity, which would affect their ability to receive Social Security income. And what the problem in the case was is that the judge never gave the jury a definition of what constituted work, and the government suggested that that work was defined as any activity that used some type of energy to produce something, which is an extremely broad definition.
The question is whether the false statements have a propensity to induce the agency to take action or to influence whatever action the agency might take. Is that not true?
That's true.
Question of whether a person is working or not, whether the person is engaged in substantial gainful activity, will influence the agency's action. Will it not?
Only if it constitutes substantial gainful activity.
No. The agency has clearly said that if you're working and not doing substantial gainful activity, we will take that into consideration. We're going to put that into our mix. So by lying, they precluded, as they wished to preclude, any further investigation by the agency. Is that not true?
Well, I think that the question was so broad. The definition of work includes any activity that uses energy.
Yes.
And when they were, if they were asked that question, I think that every single person on SSI at some point or another is engaged in the generic.
But let's just take a common use of work, which whether it's paid or unpaid, it suggests doing activities such as they were doing, i.e., working in a place that did produce income, even if not for them, and doing a fair amount of usual work activity, taking orders and taking money and serving food and so on. Now, couldn't the agency want to know about that, even if it wasn't gainful, because it was related to whether they were disabled at all?
I think the answer is no, because the agency is not, I don't think, concerned with what type of physical activities people are engaged in. I think that their interest is whether people are engaged in the type of activities that normally produce income. And
that's the type of activity that normally produces income, even if it didn't produce income for them.
I'm sorry?
That's the kind of activity that normally produces income, even if it didn't produce income for them.
Well, that's the issue. I think that the jury was never instructed that they had to make a finding that what they were engaged in was substantial gainful activity, which in effect would have affected Social Security Administration's determination on SSI. And that was the problem in our case, that the jury was never instructed, and they were led to believe that any activity could constitute work, and therefore, when they were asked the question, were you engaged in work, and they answered no.
What definition did you offer?
I think that the proper definition is that work under SSA is substantial gainful activity, and that's how the Social Security Administration defines work.
It's not how it defines work. It uses work separate from the phrase substantial gainful activity. It doesn't say work is substantial gainful activity. SGA is a subset of work.
In their administrative proceedings, substantial gainful activity is important because that determines, that's the criteria that they need to determine whether somebody's going to qualify for SSI.
Of course it's important. That's not the point. The question is whether they were working, not whether they were engaged in substantial gainful activity.
Well,
were they working?
The answer is no. Not.
If you don't crank in your specific definition of work, were they working?
If I may, Your Honor, my co-counsel was going to argue the issue of work, and I think that he wants to elaborate on
arguing it, so your co-counsel certainly can. You've got 4 minutes left.
Thank you.
How much, let's see, you represent...
Kompak Samsamuth.
You represent the husband.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. Michael Roque. I represent the wife, in this case, Kakayo. Your Honor, there was a substantial cross-examination.
Not a tag team. I suppose one of you is going to be up there or the other.
Yes, and I've been watching the clock, Your Honor. So very briefly, the Social Security representative, Ms. Shepherd, spoke during cross-examination to her familiarity with the CFRs and all the definitional, regulatory definitions that were put to her. And what she addressed was that they talked about earned income credit. The use of the word income was rife. Substantial gainful activity was rife. And we've argued that in the brief. She had two inquiries. One, were they disabled? That's a given.
Why is it a given? That's the part I don't understand. Why is it a given? As to the question of whether they're answering it falsely with a material falsehood, why is it a given? Who's giving it?
It was a given at trial. She conceded that it was a medical determination, and she had no problems with the fact that Ms. Kakayo Samsamuth had an affective disorder.
Disorder, but whether she's disabled has to do with her ability to work.
Well, she was mentally deficient, and then she went
right.
to the...
That's right, but whether she's disabled within the meaning of the SSSA, SSA depends upon, in part, whether she can work and... or do activities that are work-like, and as to that, wasn't the statement quite material?
Well, this is SSI, Your Honor, with
SSI,
all respect.
SSI, whatever it is.
And this
the point is
fresh...
that the regulations seem clearly to contemplate that the issue of whether she can work is relevant to her disability, not simply to the separate issue of whether she's incurring income.
Right. And that was Ms. Shepherd who made that bifurcation. So I'm using her particular language. She's the one who set up that interview and did the determination.
Let me ask you this. Is your client still receiving SSI?
You know, she was receiving SSI, up to the date of her sentencing, is my understanding. I don't know the answer right now.
You don't know whether she's receiving it now?
I haven't talked to her regarding it. My understanding is they were moving to stop her $600 a month.
Well, you just don't know the answer to my question.
I don't know the answer.
Okay.
You
want to save a minute for rebuttal?
You know, I will, Your Honor. I'm prepared to address the issue of sentencing if it pleases the Court.
Yeah. All right. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Richard Chang. I was trial counsel on this particular case for the government. Let me just answer the first question that the Court had. Are they still receiving SSI? Up to 6 months ago, they were receiving SSI. They had continued receiving SSI until and even after they were convicted of this case. And quite frankly, that may seem to be a strange situation, but let's look at what this particular charge was about. It was about a false statement. It is not about whether they should get SSI. That is for an administrative law judge. That is for essentially SSA to determine. In fact, after their conviction, after they were proven to be lying about not only their disability, but their ability to earn income, they still received it until, and in fact, the ALJ judge got back involved in it. Let me just highlight what I just said.
Let me ask you this. How was this loss calculated?
Loss was calculated from...
Was the total loss there, was it $17,500?
That's correct. And that was from April of 2000 to essentially the date of arrest in October. I should indicate that specifically the judge, as well as the government, had a difficult time determining how much money the government was defrauded. We did not know when they started working. We didn't know when they started having the ability to start working. All we did know is that in April of 2000, we received a letter at SSA indicating, an anonymous letter, that these people were working, and we were working specifically at a location, and it was very specific as to what they were doing when they worked. Then we start surveillance in October of that same year, and indeed, look at what they did. They take orders at a restaurant. They prepare the food. They serve the food. They take the money for the food. How that could be said to be not working defies belief. Mr. Valencia indicates that taking garbage out has never affected a determination to get or receive SSI. That makes absolutely no sense. There are two reasons why individuals receive SSI: supplemental security income benefits. You either are disabled mentally or physically, and you can't work. You have no payment. You have no ability to gain any money.
Well, was it true that at the trial the issue of whether they were disabled was, quote, a given, and what does that mean?
Well, I think when the defense says it's a given, it wasn't necessarily part of their case. Everyone expected that they didn't want to litigate this factor of whether they were first determined to be disabled or not. And indeed, the ALJ judge determined both these individuals to be disabled, both mentally and physically, back in about 8 years prior to that trial when they started receiving benefits. Now, the question again and the focus is back on the statement itself. On November 3rd of 2000, did they lie about it? Did they lie that they were able to work, and did they lie about whether they were getting any income? And clearly, whether they got income or not, they had the ability to work, and that was really at the heart of it.
But if they had the ability to work, then they wouldn't be disabled within the meaning of the statute, right?
Absolutely, and any lay person, and even the court itself would probably believe, if they had the ability to work now, 8 years after they start receiving benefits, they probably shouldn't have started receiving benefits at all.
But this is what I'm asking you, if you can slow down a little. If the investigating
person whose name I now am not remembering.
Scott Antolik.
I'm sorry, who?
SSAOIG agent Scott Antolik.
I'm talking about the woman who asked him the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. The claims representative was Ann Shepard.
Okay. Now, when did Ms. Shepard at trial in fact say that their disability was not in question?
That was not a question that was posed to her, nor an issue that the government ventured into.
All right. So the issue, because if the only materiality of the question was as to whether they were in fact earning income, then there might in fact be an issue. If the materiality went to their actual disability, i.e. their ability to work, then I think there's much less of an issue.
Well, I submit to the court that what is material is both things. In order to get SSI, in order to qualify
for disability was conceded, that's what I'm trying to find out.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But not if the disability was conceded. If everybody agreed that she was disabled, then there was no reason, or they were disabled, then one might think that it wasn't very material whether or not they weren't.
Well, I think
the closest... Everybody was agreeing that they weren't. That's what's being said by the other side. That's the part that's confusing.
Well, I still don't understand that, quite frankly, because if that was material to the determination of whether they should have started receiving it. What was material at the interview was not only their ability to work, whether they were earning any money as well. One has to go with the other.
Whether they were earning any money. There really might be a question as to the definition of working and as to the substantiality of the evidence, because... it isn't at all clear that the jury understood that to be the question, and in fact, it probably wasn't the question.
But look at the actual forms that were filled out that day during the interview itself. Not only was it a report of continuing disability, which focuses specifically on their mental and physical ability to perform work, which was at the core of the interview, but also about how much money, if in fact they do get any money, to determine, in fact, if you get SSI, yeah, you can continue getting SSI, but we will reduce SSA talking now at this point. We will reduce your amount of SSI proportionate to that amount of money that you get in. So the focus is clearly, even that day, your ability to work, and also if you are able to work just a little, how much are you getting money for, and how much will we have to reduce your benefits?
What were the amount of the SSI payments?
Well, as I understand it from Mr. Rourke has indicated, again, I believe it was approximately $600 or so per person.
For SSI?
For SSI individually. That's correct.
That's taken a big jump in the past 15 years.
Well, I mean, it's a graduated sum, depending on your living condition. If you're living with your daughter and you don't have to pay rent to the daughter, you'll get less SSI. If you're living alone because you have no children, you'll get more SSI. If you are living with another person who gets SSI, as we are in this particular case, you get less SSI individually because you combine the incomes. There is a variety of factors, and quite frankly, I would assume the court wants the SSA to have a variety of factors to look at to determine benefits. Let me just highlight again the issue of materiality. If intrinsically that question or that response has any ability to influence or a tendency to influence the agency's decision, that is material. How much more material could it be when the question is focused, can you work, and if you do work, how much money do you get? That is at the core of what the SSA needs to determine.
But the second piece is not relevant to this case because they didn't lie about that.
I'm sorry, what did they...
Second piece, as to whether or not they were earning any income. A, they were never exactly asked that question, and B, there's no evidence they were earning any income. So we have to take
Let me try to disabuse the court of whether they were asked that. They were asked specifically, do you get any money? They say no, because they don't
work.
And there's
no evidence that they lied about that, so it's out of the case.
Well, certainly they lied about that as well as their ability.
How do we know they lied about that? I thought the only evidence was that they were doing this stuff. Is there any evidence they got any money?
Well, we can – whether they pocketed the money is another thing. But we have a videotape that we presented in which Mr. Sosimov received money when the undercover agents, with a video camera, hidden video camera, take Mr. and Mrs. Sosimov take money for the noodles.
You think that's evidence that he was earning money?
Well, I mean,
he was collecting money, but it's not even. If somebody works at a charity ball and takes the money for the tickets, they're not earning money.
I don't disagree that we haven't proven that they deposited money from, say, their employers or their daughter into a bank to show that that was their particular income. But income is certainly only one of the two main focuses of that interview in which they lied about. If they're lying about their ability, they're lying also about.
Let me ask you this. The estimated loss as far as the woman was concerned was how much?
I believe it's approximately one half of the $17,500 that was.
And then when did the loss period begin?
Well, again, the court decided that the loss period began at least April of 2000 when the letter was received, the anonymous letter, and went all the way up to essentially the date of conviction.
Well, what proof was there that the loss occurred in April?
Well, not only do we have the anonymous letter.
You had the informer.
Besides
that,
that's
not evidence.
Well, besides that, it was corroborated by Mrs. Sosimo's own words and her own confession. And I have that here when she indicated that not only had she been working at that business at the Lao Community Center, but she had assisted and was working at the Lao Temple, which was the previous location of this particular restaurant. That occurred a year later. The judge didn't even count that particular portion of time within the restitution amount. She decided the most conservative way of looking at it is, hey, let's start at April of 2000 because we know you were working then. Not only did the letter, but you said it yourself in your confession. I should highlight that it's only Mrs. Sosimov that contests that restitution amount, by the way, not Mr. Sosimov. So, again, we have her letter, her statement saying.
Well, in her confession, did she say that she was, what, taking money then?
Well, let me be more specific and read it to you. The business has been in the Lao Community Center for approximately 1 year prior to that. This restaurant was operated at the Lao Temple. I also assisted with serving food and delivering the food when it was at the Lao Temple. That business was operated at the Lao Temple for approximately 1 year. This is 1 year prior to the location that we found these two individuals in, that she, meaning Mrs. Sosimov, admitted and confessed to working there. So the court took a very conservative view when it looked at restitution. It didn't even look at what Mrs. Sosimo said about what she did a year later, a year earlier at a different location.
Well, if the period began in October instead of April 2000, how would that change the calculation four-level increase?
It would be October to October. It would have a zero calculation. If we're saying that we're going to start and stop the restitution determination on the very same day.
In 2001, I thought.
I think it would decrease it by six times about six. So it would decrease it about $3,600 or so. But again, we're using April of 2000 because there is a basis.
Does that make any difference in the sentencing?
I think it would make very little difference because the one criterion that the defense wants to look at is get it below the $10,000 mark. And I should say the sentence in this case was probation only. There was no specific amount of time given to these individuals.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. On the calculation that was made, counsel.
Excuse me. Could you tell me where in the record Ms. Sherwood conceded that disability was not an issue?
It was never proven by the government. I don't have it in front of me. I do have where she says that, and counsel has mentioned that she bifurcated the change between disability and income.
There's nothing in the record of the trial where she says the disability.
I would suggest if you look at the brief, the opening brief on
page.
How much
is the brief? I don't remember. I know you said it, but I don't remember there being any.
Page 18, Your Honor, it deals with that. And also, in the record of trial 126.9 through 128.11, she talked about the fact that volunteers has no effect on income, such that if you volunteered, you don't exclude yourself from SSI. What is interesting in this case is that if work means work for income, which the regulations are rife with and she talked about, then if she said she didn't work, there's no lie. And it's interesting that they felt the need, Antolik and Shepard, to engraft the word "and volunteer" on question 11 on that massive form, whatever their motives were, or regardless, but "or volunteer" is immaterial because, as she says here, if you volunteer, it doesn't matter. And I think that gets to your question, Your Honor, about, you know, volunteering is working, not in this context, I submit. In terms of where she was working before for the year prior, which counsel talked about, and this goes to the sentencing issue, because I have a few seconds here, the Lau Community Center is just that. It's a community center. It's there's no showing that any of the work she did before, even if this confession is taken.
Are these restitution payments being deducted from whatever Social Security benefits they're getting?
Your Honor, I think she's getting Social Security.
I just asked you.
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
It's your client. Don't you know?
Well, Your Honor, I do know that they would reduce it and they will try to collect it. She has no money.
There are.
So it's they can probably do debtors' examinations till they die, but
yeah,
right now,
right.
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Fine.
You know, I could answer that if the court
would. Would you please?
Nothing has been deducted from them at all to gain restitution. The restitution amount, as it relates to SSA, is wholly a criminal matter for the government, meaning the prosecution's office, to go after, not being deducted from the SSI benefits, even if they had any at this point.
So you just really have something you can put on the wall, huh, and frame?
Well, we'd like to get the government would like to get some money back. It really would.
Okay. All right. Matter will stand submitted. Thank you. Now we come to the second item, Special Investments versus Quinn Commander Aircraft Corp. Step right up. Where's the other counsel? Oh, there you are. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. Evan Marshall for the appellant, Special Investments, and Paul Abramovitz. I think I can be very brief on this. Basically, what this comes down to is this is not a case where a twin commander can claim that it was unilaterally dragged into California courts by the action of some third party, or that it structured its commercial relationships in such a way that it was not building permanent commercial economic relationships with customers and businesses here, nor is it a case where it can claim that it did not set out to exploit the California market in some fairly direct manner. Its relationship with the service centers shows quite a deliberate...
Counsel, since the district court determined there was no subject matter jurisdiction to start with, it's decided that, right?
Yes.
And we know there's no subject matter jurisdiction in the federal courts. Wouldn't the simple thing to be just to simply vacate this order, since there was no subject matter jurisdiction in the first place, and be done with it?
That, of course, is the RurGas issue, and I would submit that that is indeed...
Well, it's sort of RurGas, except RurGas is a question of whether the district judge can take up one before another. Mm-hmm. And as far as I can tell, nobody told the district judge, aside from filing papers, nobody said to the district judge, look, there's a subject matter jurisdiction question pending before the judge decided this. And that's the RurGas question, whether the district judge abused his discretion. So it's tinged with RurGas. But my question to you is, why wouldn't we vacate it, either because it's moot now, since there was no subject matter jurisdiction, or simply because when the district court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, we should set aside any orders that have an important effect on the case?
It seems a logical approach, Your Honor.
I have a related question, which another way into the same problem. Why do we have jurisdiction over this case? As I understand it, there was a non-final order as to which there was never a 54B certification or a statement made. And then there was a remand. So there was never an appealable order in this case because the second order, the remand order, isn't appealable either. So what's appealable?
No, the remand order is not appealable. There was an order of dismissal.
Right, but that dismissal was never embodied in a final judgment of any kind because you didn't get you could have gotten but didn't get a 54B determination at the time, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, once the matter was remanded, the only thing remaining in this action before the district court was the order of dismissal.
Why is it more sensible to see the judge as having sent back the entire case, including the order that he had made but had never embodied in the final judgment?
I think that you may be correct, Your Honor. I wouldn't contest that, and it all points to having to send this matter back and ultimately back to the state court.
But there is a difference. If it's moot or if we vacate it, then the order's gone. If we don't, you're going to have to take up your question in the state court.
Well, I think we're going to...
Nobody says you can or can't do that. We'll wash our hands of it.
Yes, I would suspect, Your Honor, that we're going to end up back in the state court with respect to the jurisdictional issues in any event.
The personal jurisdiction issue?
Yes, the personal jurisdiction issue. Unless the court has any further questions.
All right.